This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
In 1971, a young actress from the Bronx who had just made her Broadway debut was offered an audition on a children's educational television show. It had already been on the air for 2 years, and it was different.
They really drummed into our heads, do not look down to the kids. This is not a kiddie show in the old style of kiddie shows.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to actress Sonia Manzano, who retired last year after 44 years of playing Maria on Sesame Street. We'll also hear about a competition to build a better robot, the competitors, eighth graders from California. And we'll spend an academic minute using artificial intelligence to make healthy choices. What could possibly go wrong? I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Several generations of children know Sonia Manzano's face and voice, but to them, her name will always be Maria. Beginning in 1971, Manzano played the role of Maria on Sesame Street. Over the years, she has won over a dozen Emmy Awards for her work as a writer on the show, and this year won a Lifetime Achievement Award at the 43rd Annual Daytime Emmy Awards. Scholastic Books recently published her memoir called Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. I spoke to Manzano recently and asked about just what being on Sesame Street meant to her life.
It's the most important and most major part of my life. I left after 44 years of being on the show. It defined me. I grew up on the show. And I finally retired last July. And when people ask me why, I give them the short answer. I say 44 years was long enough for me to wait for Oscar the Grouch to propose.
Well, I assume there's a wedding coming then. That's it.
I had my wedding on Sesame Street. As a matter of fact, if you've been watching the show, and I'm sure you have, I got married on the show and had a baby on the show and was courted on the show, and I had two boyfriends on the show. I often think that my time on Sesame Street was one of the first reality shows without the whining.
As I was looking over your career, I saw you were part of the original cast of Godspell on Broadway.
Yes, that was how it all started for me. I attended Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh as an undergrad, and Godspell was a senior project that was actually done at the school. John Michael Tabelak was the directing student, and it was his senior project, and it was this crazy show. And this was the era of hair and story theater and breaking the fourth wall and talking to the audience of that kind of musicals. And Godspell was one of them, and I was lucky enough to be cast in it. I had no idea. No one did, that it was going to be such a success. The show came to New York, and we filled it out with more actors and got the wonderful Stephen Schwartz to do the music. And there you know, it was a big hit, and I got my first audition to Sesame Street from being on that show. And I thought, why did they say show business was so hard? This was so easy. I realized later how hard it really is.
Well, when you were auditioning for Sesame Street, how did they explain that show to you? What did you think you were getting yourself into?
Well, I already knew the phenomenon that Sesame Street was, because it was so groundbreaking and so shocking, and the puppets were so hilarious. And I actually remember the first moment that I saw Sesame Street. I was a student at Carnegie Mellon at that time, and I walked into the student union, and there was James Earl Jones reciting the alphabet, and they cut to the street, and I saw Susan and Gordon, and you never saw people of color on television in those days, and that was shocking. And they were so charming and everything, and the Muppets were so hilarious. So it was already, it had been on the air 2 years. It was first aired November 69, and I auditioned in 71. So everybody knew that it was really the most exciting thing on television. I didn't think it was going to last. It's still going on over close to 50 years now. I thought it would be over in 5 years. And I just kind of did what they asked me to do. They didn't ask me to sing. And they wanted to expand the cast. As I said, there were no people of color on television in those days. The target audience was African-American children, and they wanted to expand the cast to have role models for Latino children. And that's why I came onto the show.
And they really did treat children with respect of their intelligence, didn't they?
Absolutely. That was one of the most remarkable aspects of the show. They really drummed into our heads, do not look down to the kids. This is not a kiddie show in the old style of kiddie shows where they're syrupy and children live in Never Never Land. That's why the show was set in an inner city, in the place where children live. A wonderful leader of the show, John Stone, would say to us that children, unlike the story of Peter Pan, would have us believe that children never want to grow up. His tenet was children do want to grow up. They want to know what the world is like. They want to be able to manipulate it. They want to be able to be a part of it. And so we're going to talk to them from a real place.
And spoke about issues that every child growing up has to go through. I mean, you even went through, you know, the concept of a loved one dying when Mr. Hooper passed.
Yes, that was one of the times I was most proud to be associated with the show, and that was kudos to Dulcie Singer, who was the producer at the helm at that time, and Will Lee, the actor who played Mr. Hooper, died, and we were all wondering what to do, how to explain his absence, and everybody said, oh, we'll just say that he retired or that he went to Florida, and she said, no, wait a minute, if our premise is to show children the world as it exists, this is the world as it exists. People die. Death isn't a man-made thing. We just often encourage it, but we didn't invent it. So death is being part of the natural order of things. She thought it was important to clarify it in the level that a child could understand. And after a lot of research, that was made clear to us.
Not many people may know this, but you were also a writer on the show. You wrote many of the scripts, didn't you?
Yes. I started writing in the 80s, I suppose. I really, really wanted to contribute more to the show. And being an actor, you can contribute so much, but the real fun, I noticed that the writers and the directors are having even more fun than me, if you can imagine that. And also, I questioned the Latino content of the show. There were no Latin writers. There were no female writers at that time. And the same producer, Dulcie Singer, said, why don't you try writing some of your bits yourself? And that's how I started to write. And of course, I wrote that bit of me dressed up as Ginger Rogers. I think that was one of my first efforts.
Talk about some of the reactions and interactions you get with your audience. I'm sure you get a lot from Latinos, but it must be just kids of all sizes and shapes.
Oh, I have been very gratified since my retirement from the show that I've received so many letters and well wishes saying how I was the first person that people related to on television. A Latin girl say, you reminded me of my mother or my sister or my best friend. I felt that I was part of the world. And it wasn't to inspire you to be on television. It was to inspire people to see that they were part of the world. And I know exactly what that felt like because I'm Puerto Rican and I was born in the 50s and raised and watched a lot of television as I was growing up in the South Bronx. And when I didn't see myself reflected in the media in any way, I didn't know what I was going to contribute to a society that didn't see me. People would say, what are you going to be when you grow up? And you would have no thought or ideas because you never saw Latin teachers or doctors or anything in the world. So I knew that I was being a remedy to that terrible situation. And also, on the other hand, you know, people who are not Latin say, you were the first Latin I ever saw as a real person, because they lived in, I don't know, a homogenous society somewhere. And so I couldn't have had a better response after my retirement. And I still love to hear all those responses. So I wish people would stop crying, which they tend to do.
While you were on the show, you acted not only with children, but with Muppets. What was more challenging?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, children, you have to be on your toes because they might take the scene in another direction innocently. And puppeteers, you have to stay on your toes because they'll take a scene in a different direction on purpose just to see you squirm. My first bit was with Frank Oz, and he was playing Grover. And I remember I kept I couldn't get used to looking at this puppet's eyes because they were like two ping pong balls. And I looked down at my feet where the puppeteer Frank Oz was, and he said to me in Grover's voice, "Stop looking at that man down there." And that cured me, and I was able to do the scene. And my wonderful friend Carol Spinney, who plays Big Bird, all in jest when I was first on the show and really quite nervous, he said to me, "While wearing the bird suit, don't worry, Sonia, there's only going to be millions and millions of people watching this."
No pressure at all. None.
I know. But they were fun. I mean, after a while, they become whole entities. You can improvise with them and fantasize about having dinner with them and being off the set with them.
Well, now that you've retired, is your career as a writer going to continue?
Yes. I'm working, as you know, I have my latest book is Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx, and it's a memoir, and the publisher is Scholastic. This is my second book with Scholastic. They're young adult novels, but this is a memoir, as I said, and three picture books with Simon & Schuster, and there's going to be more coming from me and Scholastic as the publisher.
Well, I see you've been talking to schools and you've been talking to some public TV stations and other groups about your career and about education in general on television. What do you talk about when you go to these events? What do people want to hear about? Is it all, you know, my life on Sesame Street, or do you talk about just the state of educational or kids' TV today?
Oh, my gosh. I will talk about how the landscape of television has changed so profoundly. When we started the show, it was geared towards preschoolers, which was kids that were 5 years old. And this was the days when kids did not even learn the alphabet until they were in the first grade. Can you imagine that? And now kids pick up so much more information so much earlier than we thought, that there's programming geared towards two-year-olds now. So I'll certainly talk about how the landscape of television has changed and how we went from magazine format to a longer narrative, and how children's television reflects the way the general shape of television is forming. And I'll do anecdotes of the cast and talk about my own personal upbringing and how that helped me become the best Maria possible.
Again, the name of Sonia Manzano's new memoir is Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. It's published by Scholastic Books. Still to come, what this country's eighth graders need is to build a better robot. No, really, that's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. California eighth graders are ranked 45th in the country in math, according to the most recent scores on the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Meanwhile, the pool of jobs requiring math, science, and engineering experience is growing, especially in the Bay Area. For people with the right skills, these jobs have become the latest iteration of the American dream: steady, livable wages and plenty of demand. In San Francisco, a few high schools have started offering hands-on tech experience to students in after-school robotics clubs. George Washington High School in San Francisco's Richmond District is one of them. They recently entered a national robot building competition of 3,000 teams. They had 6 weeks to build a robot that can lift and stack big plastic bins for a regional contest in Davis. For the program Cross Currents, Hannah Kingsley Ma reports.
Students are clustered in a small classroom. They are hunched over computer screens and sipping from bucket-sized bubble teas. And on the floor, there's something that looks like a car battery got in a fight with a Roomba. It scoots back and forth on command. Taxi C2 says the first time they made it move,
everyone took their phone out and started taking pictures of it. That's about it.
The Eaglebots have 6 weeks to turn this pile of wires into a robot that can lift and stack big plastic bins. That's the requirement to compete in an upcoming regional contest in Davis against robots just like it. It's part of a national competition of 3,000 teams. This is week three. The Eaglebots have been working on the robot every day after school, all day on Saturdays, too.
You don't come on Sundays.
Yeah, school's closed on Sundays.
Yeah. We would if we could, but they don't let us.
That's Sheldon Lau and Michael Kwong, two high school seniors in the club. In a lot of ways, this looks like any other high school classroom. The students are milling around, rummaging for snacks, partaking in lively debate.
No, you can.
You can't.
You can.
You cannot.
They said you can.
But what they are doing, it is way more complicated than anything I remember doing at this age. Not only do these students have to build and design a robot from scratch, they have to write code to make it perform specific functions. Here's Eaglebot Isaac Ng, a senior.
I do timer dot delay. So basically it will turn on the motor for at 100% speed and then wait for 5 seconds and then turn it off.
For Ng and everyone else on the team, robot building is a completely new experience. And there are only so many people who can help them. Many of the adults in their lives have little understanding of what they are doing. Here's Sheldon Lau again.
My parents aren't really into this techie stuff. So I tell them I'm building a robot and they think I'm building some sort of android that's going to destroy the world or something.
You think there's just like sort of a generational divide?
I think it's because my parents, they don't like work in these kinds of fields, like the engineering field or computer science or anything. They did kind of like simple labor work, so this is kind of a different world to them.
So instead, the internet has become their textbook. They also get help from mentors from nearby tech companies, more seasoned high school competitors, and teachers. Computer science teacher John Hagel is advisor to the Eaglebots.
This is the second year of computer science at Washington. They had it years and years ago, but then budget cuts happened. This year we have 4 computer science classes, so
wow.
About 120 students. It's really good. And we had to limit some of the students.
Hagel wanted students to get more hands-on computer science training. So did senior Stephanie Tam. She had friends on Lowell High School's Accomplished Cardinalbotics team. So they started a club just like it. Interest wasn't a problem, but
the school just didn't have the money.
The parts for the robot cost thousands of dollars alone. A neighborhood organization helped the club get $20,000 from Facebook. Tech money in the SFUSD isn't a new thing. This past year alone, Salesforce.com donated $5 million to the district. Hagel says he's grateful for the resources, but the tech giants make some educators uneasy.
Will they have a say in the curriculum? Will they have a say in hiring? You know, things like that. So we want to make sure that as teachers that we do appreciate the money, but we don't want them to affect the way things are taught.
As for the students, they're not sure what they're going to do 5 or 6 years from now. But whatever it is, they think this experience will prove useful. Here's Lau.
Participating in this club kind of gives us a sense of how a big company, a big tech company works. There's a software team, there's a build team. Everything's kind of linked together and we all have to work together.
I got this.
It's week 6 now, and the robot is undergoing testing to make sure it is competition ready. Some of the students have morphed into robot paramedics. Here's club president Stephanie Tam.
So far, we've bent the robot.
You what?
Bent the robot.
Oh, you've bent the robot?
Yeah, a little bit. See, the arms are like kind of slanted down. It's not supposed to be like that.
The robot is about 7 feet tall now, with pincher arms that slide up and down its large frame. When I asked him what she thinks it looks like, she demurely tells me a guillotine.
Go forward, forward, forward. That. You're good.
The students maneuver it inside of the elevator to get it outside onto the school's blacktop. It's a delicate process.
We went to the wrong floor, and now we have to ask for the elevator keys.
Once outside, the robot trains next to the school's lacrosse and tennis team. The other students passing by pause to admire the Eaglebot's handiwork.
Back it up.
The team practices making the robot run at certain speeds and stacking large boxes on top of one another. Each time the robot successfully completes a task, the students look equal parts delighted and surprised. Their advisor, John Hadgel, is right there with them.
This test is very important. Okay, turn it this way. You're gonna go fast. Stop. Short.
This is the last week the Eaglebots will be allowed to work on their robot, lovingly dubbed the McKinneagle. The students step back and admire their handiwork, taking pictures of it on their phone against the backdrop of the Golden Gate Bridge. Senior Sheldon Lau is one of them.
You guys are taking pictures of the robot. What are you going to do with them?
I'm just mostly going to show it to my family, you know, to show that, you know, I've done something.
In San Francisco, I'm Hannah Kingsley Ma for Cross Currents.
We humans have a lot of choices to make during the day, but when it comes to making healthy ones, we might need a little help. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Artificial intelligence could help you make healthier food choices. I am Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Robert Edgell, professor of technology management at SUNY Polytechnic Institute, details how AI can keep you on the right dietary track.
We humans are confronted with an increasingly complex array of dietary and pharmaceutical choices that influence health and well-being. However, many consumers struggle to make decisions that optimize ingestion or eating decisions. More than ever, scientific information about the health implications of diverse substances has become available. Yet consumers' potential to carefully analyze this disclosed information, then understand possible interactions among substances, and reach individualized health-optimizing decisions may be limited by a variety of factors. Our research was guided by the question, how might the use of artificial intelligence, or AI, help consumers make better decisions about their food choices, as well as medicine and food interactions? In response, we developed a conceptual framework that outlined how artificial intelligence might be used by consumers to increase their likelihood of experiencing more predictable and optimized health outcomes. AI, applied through smartphones and personal computers, could set eating routines and generate intelligent menus to minimize negative interactions among medicines, foods, and other substances. Furthermore, AI could help discern negative intra-food interactions that might be found in multi-component food assemblies, such as the ubiquitous cheeseburger or pizza. So imagine a future in which the smartphone may become your best companion for a healthy dinner.
That was Robert Edgell of SUNY Polytechnic Institute. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.